This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Joe Whitworth, president of the Freshwater Trust, a nonprofit river restoration organization. Joe hosts the podcast Freshwater Talk, blogs for Huffington Post, and has been published in both popular and technical journals. Joe Whitworth is here today to tell us about his book, Quantified, Redefining Conservation for the Next Economy, published in 2015. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Diane. Good morning.
Why did you write Quantified? What is your purpose?
Well, you know, I've gotten to the point where I feel pretty strongly that we need to recalibrate the environmental effort that we've been working on for so long, and where we have spent so much time over the last few decades really admiring the problem. I wanted to stipulate the problem or set of problems, recognize them, and then lay out some paths forward that will really become the earmarks of the next era of conservation, which I believe is going to be heavily quantified and very transparent in terms of where we're at, where we're going, and what progress we're making.
In what ways is the typical approach to conservation less effective than it might be?
You know, I think it's a matter of times changing. At my organization, we helped list several of the first Pacific salmon species under the Endangered Species Act in the late 90s and going forward, and that was a big game changer. And we thought we were going to see some new things happen there. But what we really did was we just found another way to stop bad things from happening. And we've really, through advocacy and litigation, you know, that's become the core competency of the environmental movement, which has now grown into the environmental sector. And what happened was that we need to recognize is the world changed. The world has changed fundamentally from 1970. I mean, if you drop somebody on Earth today, they would not necessarily recognize it. I mean, population has doubled to more than 7 billion. U.S. population has grown by 55%. The amount of pesticides in the U.S. has tripled to more than 1 billion pounds a year. The number of worldwide dead zones has gone from 30 to more than 500. And these are things that happened while we were on watch, but we weren't really watching. And so first off, we're setting up a flare in the book that says, hey, the world changed, we need to change too. And here's how.
What can be done to make our approach to conservation more effective?
And the great irony in all this is, you know, back when the sort of environmental pioneers came up with the idea that we need to have procedures and regulations to really stop an economy or slow down an economy that had fundamentally overreached and was completely not recognizing the values of the environment. The irony here is we were the innovators at one point, and business were the big bad guys, and government were the good guys. And all of these things have flipped. The environmental movement really isn't innovating all that much. Business is starting to pay more and more attention to sustainability and accounting for their supply chain and so forth. And government has now become the whipping boy of the environmental community, whereas before they used to be partners. And so a lot of things have shifted, but again, we didn't. And so there are tools available to us, and a lot of them built, discovered, explored through business, such as, you know, just technology, the ability to understand data in a fundamentally new way, to be able to access information remotely, to be able to see things from satellites that before we just couldn't. And so we need to recognize that this flip has happened, not be so constrained by doing things the way we have always done them, but do them the way that we can and the way that they need to be done.
Well, you've begun alluding to this, but what is quantified conservation?
Quantified conservation is about using 21st century tools to deal with 21st century problems. And what it allows us to do is use a framework of five elements to ensure that every action that we take translates into positive outcomes for the environment. And basically, the five elements that I kind of distilled after studying several problems and solutions, both in the environmental sector and other social sectors and even in business, are situational awareness. You have to know what's going on in real time. And it can't be what you want to have going on. It's what's really happening, both internally to you and externally. Then we have to focus on outcomes, not little outcomes, not kind of patch and tinker, you know, a few percentage points gain here and there, but big ones, 1,000% gain, 10x, really fundamentally changing what we're going after. And then once you know you've got an issue and you know where you're going, then you begin to use innovation and technology. It's kind of a design thinking way to approach the problem. And from there, we can engage data and analytics, which allow us to understand in real time the progress that we're making from where we started to where we need to be. And the last element is a notion of gain. Now, we've always thought about that in our economy as financial gain, but now we can truly track environmental uplift in a physical and applied way. And what that allows us to do is to embed environmental gain along with social and financial gain. And that's really what we have to do. It's not okay for us to just hold the line at this point. I mean, the stressors that are coming in on our freshwater ecosystems and many of our other natural systems are just so far depleted that we really have to make up time in a pretty significant way from here on out. And so holding the line isn't good enough. Gain is really what we're after.
Let's look at water health and availability from the point of view of quantified conservation. First, some background. What is the current status of streams and rivers in the U.S.?
Well, it's not good news. The reality is more than half, something like 55% of our 3.7 million stream miles are impaired under the Clean Water Act today. This is a full generation or more since we started the effort to make our waters fishable, swimmable, drinkable. And the reality is many or most of the pipes that were first regulated under the Clean Water Act, which was really the precipitating event for the Clean Water Act when we had chemical plants just sending waters out and, you know, with petroleum refineries and so forth, just sending byproducts out into the water as kind of a dump that led to the Cuyahoga River burning in 1969. Actually, it had burned several times in several decades before that. But the real problems are a little harder to see with conventional tools. It's non-point source runoff. They happen in very small and really disparate ways across the landscape. I mean, if you look at like the Mississippi system, which drains more than 30 states in the upper Midwest and throughout the heart of the country, you can't really see those things coming off the land. You can't see the sediment. You can't see the nitrates. You can't see the phosphorus. You can't see the temperature gain from simplified landscapes not blocking sunlight in to heat the water up until it gets all the way down into the Gulf of Mexico, and the oxygen needed to break down that supercharged soup of pesticides and nutrients creates a dead zone the size of, you know, 8,000 square miles. And so what we have to do is find a way to really attack the problem at the source. And that takes a lot of new tools, because under the Clean Water Act, we can't really regulate agriculture. So we have to find a way that gets the job done, given where we are from a legal standpoint. And that has to do with really finding the right incentives, using tools with greater precision than we have in the past to find out really where do we need to focus our effort, where do we need to focus our philanthropic dollars, our public dollars at the state, federal, and local levels to honestly solve the problems as an applied matter. For too long, we have kind of assumed that if we write good things down on a piece of paper and win them in court, it'll somehow fix the problem. But that's not been borne out to be true. If you look at it on paper, the environmental war is over and the Greens won. But the through line all the way to the ground doesn't look the same. We have miles and miles and miles to go, and pressures are mounting all the time. So we have to find some new tactics.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Joe Whitworth, president of the Freshwater Trust and author of the book, Quantified, Redefining Conservation for the Next Economy. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you say that our current system to address water issues is disorganized. Would you explain?
We don't have, quote, like a federal water law that is integrated, or even state laws that are integrated. I mean, we have many that have that name. But the fact is we have organized ad hocery as it relates to water. We have, of course, the Clean Water Act that attacks some of the issues. You have the Endangered Species Act and the species that are dependent on freshwater ecosystems. You have NEPA policy actions that are really looking at procedure before decisions are made at the federal level. We have Superfund, we have RCRA, we have federal drinking water, we have state corollaries of all of these things, and then we have water quantity issues that are really governing surface waters, and those are a state-by-state issue. Two different types in the United States. You have riparianism in the east, and you have prior appropriation in the west, and then you have groundwater that's largely unregulated. So to say that we have an integrated water scheme at all is completely without basis. And so we really do need to have an organizing principle here that has to do with understanding precisely how much water we have, kind of a water budget, if you will, that has attributes that speak to things like water quality as well as water quantity, and understand that we have to stay within that envelope. If there is one big takeaway from the book, it is that we live in the ultimate closed loop. I mean, the biosphere has no more water today than it did when Earth opened up for business, right? That hasn't changed. But what has changed fundamentally is when or whether the water turns up and in what shape it turns up. And what we have to do is understand that we have this ultimate closed loop, but we have had to date open-ended accounting, right? Both economically and environmentally. And what we need to do is use tools like satellite images and LIDAR, which is using light to detect the state that the water and the river systems are in, and other remote sensing capacities to truly understand what the water budget is and how we're doing against it. And we have to derive everything from that. You know, if you added up all the water rights that people have claim to, it would be as high as the ceiling in whatever room you're in. And if you added up the actual physical water we had, it would be about half that high. And so we're overdrawing all the time. And we're now getting to the place in human history where we can't do that anymore. And so you can look at it and say, oh no, it's going to be a drag coefficient to the economy. That's a false statement. What it's going to drive is massive innovation and entrepreneurial opportunities that actually can drive some great economic gains right alongside with environmental gains. And that's where we have to go.
How is the approach of quantified conservation being used to restore rivers and address water issues? What are some examples?
Well, I searched kind of the world over and the country over and found several, but I might speak from personal experience. Here at the Freshwater Trust a few years ago, we had figured out that we can really understand and account for what happens when you go out and you fix an acre alongside a stream. You know, if you plant a tree, what does it really do? It's not just an aesthetic thing or a pretty thing, great place to have a picnic. And this is with the advent of ecosystem services. We can understand nature for not just what it is, you know, a tree or a wetland, but what it does. That tree can stabilize bank and keep a specific amount of pounds of sediment out of the river, and we can quantify that. It can take up nutrients into its root system, and we can quantify that. It can sequester carbon, and we can quantify that. It can keep solar inputs from coming into a watershed, and we can quantify that. And so several years ago, we were in discussions with a town of about 100,000 people in southern Oregon along the Rogue River, one of the first eight wild and scenic rivers, and they had a permit that they needed to comply with under the Clean Water Act. In salmon country, temperature can be considered a pollutant under that act, and so when you take things down the drain and you have to treat them, a lot of times you heat them up, And before you can legally return them to the waterway, you need to cool them down to a salmon-appropriate temperature. And so they were looking at doing, as most folks had, they were looking at doing a big built gray cooling chamber, and then they'd have to pump it in and let it cool and pump it out and then pump it into the river. And it was going to cost them about $20, $22 million, and it was going to take care of their requirement of 300 million kilocalories a day. The unit of trade was a kilocalorie, right? So we were able to understand how to build a kilocalorie using natural infrastructure, planting trees to keep a watershed cool. And essentially, we were able to build them 600 million kilocalories per day, and we're able to do it for a cost of $6 or $7 million. We're able to put local folks to work doing the restoration, doing the monitoring, and we can compensate landowners for essentially growing bushels of nature. So we're going to get a two-for-one deal for the environment at a minimum. We're going to generate some economic benefits down in that community. They're going to meet their compliance, and we're going to restore that river because those trees are doing certainly more than just generating kilocalories. They're sequestering carbon, they're holding back sediments, and they're pulling out the nutrients that would have otherwise been going into the system. So it's kind of a win-win-win-win-win setup, and that's something that we want to see replicated in a very standardized way across the country. And very recently, President Obama, as recently as last week, issued a memo to agencies when they are considering public expenditures like this, they need to look at natural infrastructure. So we're pretty pleased with that, in part because in the press release where they did it, they noted our work. So, you know, I think this really does signify where the world has begun to turn, and we're on the leading edge. So I'm pretty excited about that.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Joe Whitworth, president of the Freshwater Trust and author of the book, Quantified, Redefining Conservation for the Next Economy. You've said a bit about this already, but what are some of the new technologies being used to help address water issues?
Well, there are several. Some of the ones that are most exciting to me really do come down to our ability to have transparency and understanding where we are in real time. One of the maps that I use in the book shows the 55% of streams that are impaired under the Clean Water Act. And happily, those graphs are not in color in the book because it is an ugly map with a lot of red lines on it. And the map itself is kind of a downer, but the reality is that how that map was made is emblematic of where we are. It took us something on the order, and I mean, when I say us, I mean the government agencies and all their science partners and so forth, took them more than a decade to put together and crunch and model. And that's a long time in a world where we have something on the order of 13,000, I mean, literally an army of satellites that circle the Earth every 90 minutes and send high-resolution photos of the Earth back to us, right? And today, we don't have to wait that long for information. And one of the problems is the environmental sector, the governmental sector, and to a large degree, the philanthropic sectors have not really absorbed and started to utilize technology in this way. And, you know, what we're finding, we've been able to put all of the agency's requirements into an algorithm that can essentially help make decisions instantly as opposed to doing it sequentially if you're looking for a permit. The same is also true of philanthropic dollars. If philanthropy can be clear on what they want, we know that we can more efficiently get work done on the ground with not just us, but with our partners. And what we want to be able to do is really begin to do things in seconds instead of months, in the same way that this is the technology that allowed us to see TurboTax revolutionize how we file taxes, or the same way Amazon made sure that we can get any book ever written in any language anywhere in the world in 60 seconds. So technology, if we apply it right here, can streamline processes without shortchanging the environment, and that is a big step forward. We can save time, we can stretch the dollars that we're already spending, and we can better our results. And so it is a matter of transforming our effort from being largely manual to becoming much more automated and pushes into the future, really.
How could quantified conservation be used to address water shortage issues in the Colorado River?
Well, the Colorado, as you know, it was a river that was strong enough to carve the Grand Canyon from stone. And so it's really shocking to think that that is now a river that doesn't always meet the ocean. And again, the issue there is we have a water budget that we have completely disregarded. And so what we need to do in the Colorado is much akin to what we've seen happen in the Murray-Darling Basin in Australia. They had over a couple of decades, they had the big dry. And this is the driest inhabited continent in the world. So when they say drought, they mean drought. And what they realized was that the water that they had was far less than the water rights were allowing people to take each year. And so, again, they moved into deficit. They drained almost that entire river system, and it caused a lot of problems. So what they said was, we're going to bring this back into a water budget that is resilient, which means we're going to know exactly how much water we have in a year. To the extent that people's water rights are pulled back, we're going to compensate them for that, which is something that we can do in the United States as well. And we're going to keep a minimum of environmental flows and social flows in there so that we have drinking water and recreation and so forth. And then above that, we're going to prorate our shares among users. And users can avail themselves of a water market each year so they can know how much water they have and they can make a choice. Do I want to grow something this year or do I want to use water as my crop and send it into the market? And what's happened over time is water, as indexed against other commodities, has paid better than many of the other agricultural commodities that are out there. And there has been a natural migration from, you know, low-value water-intensive crops like rice to high-value water-frugal crops. So what we're seeing is a shift in what is produced, how it's produced, when it's produced, and under what conditions. And they've been able to strike a new balance. And we're going to have to do the same kind of thing in the United States. We'll have to make allowance for the things that are different, but really we're talking about the laws of physics and water availability and recharge. And in a world that does have climate change, we have to be flexible if we expect to be resilient.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I think for me in all of this, the great thing here is we can fix this. And really what I wanted to do was kind of shake us and say, stop sleepwalking and believing that more of the same is going to somehow fix it. It's not. And we only have all objective measures of the environment heading in the wrong direction to prove it. The world has fundamentally changed. The tools that we used to use with great success are simply outmoded. They are outmatched, outgunned, and they will not do it. And so for me, I'm not okay with just sitting on the answer. We have got to stand up. We have got to take big strides, and we've got to get this done. And not just because it's some moral imperative or the right thing to do, but for me, you know, I grew up, my dad was a carpenter, and we would turn up at a house, and we would figure out what the problem was, and if they accepted dad's bid, we would come back every day until we fixed their problem. And one of the things that is no longer okay is to just work on this problem. We have got to solve it, and we can. So we have to. We need to. So let's do it. It's kind of the big imperative for me. And I'm really enthusiastic that we can and have laid out what is a very replicable and usable framework to get after that. In the end, I'm actually pretty excited about where we're at right now.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like to leave the listeners with this. Jim Jannard founded Oakley, the eyeglass company, and he had this great quote. And what he said was everything in the world can and will be made better. The only questions are when and by whom. And to this challenge, I answer now and by us. Because we can do this. So let's go out and do this.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Joe.
You bet. It was great to talk to you this morning.
You were just listening to Joe Whitworth, president of the Freshwater Trust and author of the book Quantified, Redefining Conservation for the Next Economy, published in 2015 by Island Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.